The Guardian.
I'm Tom Clark, and with me in the studio are The Guardian's Polly Toynbee, Michael White and Larry Elliott, all here to discuss the legacy of the Prime Minister who stood on the steps of Downing Street and promised to bring harmony in place of discord. Polly Toynbee, how do you think she measured up against that standard?
She certainly never meant it, and she certainly didn't deliver it. She brought a great deal of discord. She believed in creative destruction. She had quite a finely tuned political theorist's view of the world, and she did set about destruction. Some of it was creative, most of it, I would say, not.
And Mike?
I had a call this morning from a friend in the north who said that his uncle Gilbert had been keeping a bottle of champagne in the fridge for this day and he had just opened it. Feelings in the north of England and in Scotland, politically significant in a different way, disaffection with Toryism in Scotland, is still enormous. I disagree with Polly about Thatcher's sincerity. She looked at the post-war settlement in Britain and thought it was coming apart at the seams, which the Labour government and the trade union movement gave her considerable assistance in doing. And in any case, part of the story of Thatcherism, I think, which is never told, that she's a manifestation of the first impact of globalisation on the British and Western European economies, not least the oil hike, which preceded her rise to power and caused Ted Heath's fall in no small measure, trade union movement as well. So she's part of a bigger picture, just as our friend Ronnie Reagan is part of a bigger picture.
And Larry, would you say on the, you know, Mike says it's a story with a big economic aspect. Do you think she was a product of her times economically, or do you think she reforged her times?
Bit of both, I think. I think that in the 1970s, she was probably a bit less radical than the subsequent mythology would have had it. She was actually quite pragmatic. She didn't really get to grips with trade union reform until after the Winter of Discontent. But she was certainly rooted in a certain growing ideology associated with the free market think tanks like the IEA and the CPS. So she was well plugged into what was going on there. And they supported her strongly when she was vying with Ted Heath for the leadership. So she was a bit of both. She was a bit of ideology, but she was certainly a much more pragmatic politician than people give her credit for. And she was much more careful about the way in which she sequenced the reforms than people would often give her credit for. For example, privatisation didn't happen in the first term of Thatcherism. It happened in the second, only after they won a second big landslide majority. So she was quite careful. And there are areas of reform, welfare, for example, which were left pretty much untouched by the Tories. Certainly the big welfare reforms in Britain happened after Thatcher rather than during her time there. So she was a much cannier politician than people give her credit for, I think.
Take Mike up on what Mike said about this was the early part of globalisation. I mean, that's an interesting idea, and though, you know, she came into power at a time of great recession. But if you compare us with, say, Germany and a lot of what else was going on in Europe, they didn't have the same take on it. They didn't move halfway across the Atlantic in the way that we did psychologically. I think that she really was the architect of changing the way Britain thought in quite important ways that didn't happen elsewhere, subject to the same global pressures.
Well, everybody's history is different. I think Gerhard Schroeder, who did labour market reforms in the 1990s, and certainly Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who was a contemporary of Thatcher's, were well aware that she was doing something to the post-war settlement, which they might have to do in due course. They did it rather better, I'll certainly concede you that. One other contextual point, of course, Jim Callaghan famously said, "The tide goes out once in a generation. It's going out on us. Mrs. Thatcher's are going to win. Nothing I can do to change it." But whoever won that election in 1979, as Callaghan also knew, was going to get North Sea oil. And part of the debate is whether or not Thatcher could better have used North Sea oil than to do what she did in terms of restructuring the economy, restructuring society at large.
Still a divisive figure, as Mike was saying. I mean, I remember as a child growing up in the north of England, it's appalling really to remember this, but going to a bonfire, my parents disapproved of this bonfire, but weeks after the 1984 bombing of the Grand Hotel in Brighton, people down the road, just teachers and social workers, had done up their bonfire as a Grand Hotel with Margaret Thatcher on top. And it's quite amazing to think of, you know, we're not talking about Republican Derry here or something, we're talking about suburban Huddersfield.
Well, that's because there had been a very brutal wiping out of most of a large chunk of British industry centred in the north and in the regions in the early 1980s. I mean, no, very few people, I think, even the Tory party, thought that the country would be able to sustain 3 million people unemployed.
The question for an economist, which you are and I am not, is how much of that was doomed to go, or with a more nuanced economic policy of intervention, more cooperation with the unions perhaps, and vice versa, how much of it could have been saved?
Well, perhaps some of it could have been saved. I think that it was fairly, it was a fairly brutal and fairly unthinking sort of policy in the early 1980s, and it could have been finessed a bit better. But the fact is that the British economy had been underperforming for the previous 25 years compared to other countries. So there was an extent to which Britain had not been paying its way in the world, even in the 1960s and 1970s. So some of that shakeout was, I think, inevitable. I think we had a lot of uncompetitive companies who really weren't washing their face. The fact is, though, that, you know, pushing interest rates to 17% in pursuit of monetary targets, which is what the...
It was still negative interest rates given the rate of inflation at the time.
I don't think it was a negative interest. I mean, it was a really, really tough squeeze on the economy when the Tories came in. And it could have, you know, you had mentioned earlier that they did have the benefit of North Sea oil. I think if a properly social democratic government might well have used that to retool the British.
Our side of the argument had blown it. That's the embarrassing part of these conversations. Sure. And Polly's SDP breakaway was a manifestation of frustration with the Labour Party. Legitimate frustration. You can argue about whether it was the right response, but you could see where the Labour government, which we all knew and probably all voted for, was going wrong. Unions, horrible.
Polly, when you think about Margaret Thatcher in terms of her legacy now, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, trying to think if she's going to be remembered differently because she's died now rather than if she'd died before the financial crisis, before Cameron came into Downing Street. Do you think she looks a bigger or a smaller figure than she did 5 or 6 years ago?
She seems very relevant. She doesn't seem like ancient history because we now have a government of her heirs and successors who were brought up as students with posters of her on the wall and who were rather crude imitators, not as clever, not as canny as she is. Also don't know when to stop, that they will rush headlong at things that she was cautious about. So I think that makes us reflect back and think that she was really quite skillful and quite politically adept. She won 3 elections, and it's very unlikely this lot will.
And Mike, it was always said by everyone from the far right to the far left that Margaret Thatcher knew how to pick her fights. Do you think that the likes of George Osborne, who grew up with the posters on the wall, suppose the legend has it, would have got carried away with the myth of Thatcher that she could take on everyone at once?
I think there is a myth of Margaret Thatcher, and Larry has already touched upon it, that she was actually much more cautious and pragmatic. Until the end, they all end up believing their own press releases. I went to live in America in 1984, actually a week after the Brighton bomb, which I managed to sleep through. Slightly the worse for wear. I'd left the Grand Hotel 10 minutes before it happened, but never mind. I came back in 1989 and she was dressing like the Empress Catherine the Great. The transformation, the gates were up on Downing Street, not her fault, IRA's fault. Transformation to the woman who believed that she could push through the poll tax as an act of political will. And all sorts of people on the left believed that politics was all about will and not much more. You had the determination to do it. Ken Livingstone was a classic on this one. He really admired her. But it isn't like that. In fairness to her, she was more practical and more pragmatic. And at the early stages of the coalition, they really were teenage Thatcherites who thought that's all. Margaret laid down the law and she didn't blink. George Osborne says there is no alternative. They're wrong. It would be interesting to know whether Thatcher would have reviewed the evidence at this stage in the life of the coalition and thought this ain't working.
Gosh, and Larry, do you think that she changed Britain's place in the world? That was always a big part of her self-image, I think, wasn't it? That Britain was on some irreversible decline from the 45 victory and the heyday of defeating Nazi Germany and to the kind of malaise of the 70s that you were talking about before. Do you think she arrested that?
Yes, I think she did for a while. I think that recent events have slightly altered that perception, but I think for a while, certainly in the 80s and 90s, Britain's economic performance relative to other countries did improve. That our growth rates did actually climb to the levels and actually go above the levels of some of our European competitors in a way they weren't in the 1960s and 1970s. Yes, I think that, you know, whether you agree with what she did in the Falklands or not, that actually helped to actually restore Britain's reputation on the global stage in a way that Suez had actually, you know, 25 years previously had actually diminished Britain's reputation. So I think that by the end of her period in office, that Britain was perceived no longer as the sort of sick man of Europe in the way that it certainly was in 1979 when she came to power.
Do you think it made a difference in the relationship with America, Mike?
Yeah, she was already, you know, playing footsie with President Reagan, who admired her brains and energy, and she had admired his folksy charm, and not particularly, not a lot going on there, she once said of his brains, great charm, and a sort of big picture sense Reagan, you know, is an anti-communist and pro-enterprise, and so was she, low taxation, all that stuff which has since brought us down to ruin, but never mind. So with the Falklands, that kind of reinforced perfect PR. Suddenly, the Iron Lady, La Dame de Fer, whatever we say in Spanish, those macho drunken soldiers down in Buenos Aires picked the wrong fight, didn't they? Although Thatcher let it happen. Because she won, she got away with it. The fact is all sorts of people, including David Owen and Jim Callaghan, were warning her that this was serious in the winter of 1982. They cut the defence budget badly, took away the ship, the Endurance, and ended up with a huge and costly war in terms of blood, but mainly treasure, which still goes on, though she may be lucky if we keep the oil.
Many of her reforms have had sort of slow burn effects. I mean, I think that, you know, some of the things that happened at the time were considered to be great successes, you know, smashing the trade unions, you know, selling off council houses, changing the direction of the economy away from manufacturing to services. But they have actually had quite big long-term legacy effects, not all of which have been positive. So, for example, you know, you look at what's happening today for the welfare debate. Why are in-work benefits so great? It's because wages aren't going up very rapidly, and that's because the trade union movement was smashed by Thatcher in the 1980s. People can't actually bid up the price of their labour. You know, why is the housing benefit bill so high? Because we're not building enough social housing.
She introduced it.
Yeah. Why are we not? You know, there is a housing shortage, therefore rents are very high, and people are actually, you know, housing benefit is needed so people can live in the southeast of England. You know, why is our economy, you know, not growing? Because there's a very small productive manufacturing base. Far too much of it was based around property and financial services. Not enough of it was based around building things over the last 10 or 15 years. So some of the impacts of Thatcherism in the 80s at the time looked like it was great. You know, it was sort of, you know, making firms more competitive, bringing down the level of taxation, allowing people to buy their own homes, which in themselves, you know, was something that the Labour Party also was looking at, council house sales. But some of these things did have very, very grievous long-term impacts on the UK economy. And you have to wonder, could we have done it better? Could the benefits of North Sea Oil have been used in a more productive way to actually make Britain a better country today, a more thriving economy than it is today?
Polly, of course, it was a time of international tension, the so-called Second Cold War, the early 80s, wasn't it, where the days of detente seemed to be numbered, and it briefly looked like we were going back to the edge with the Soviet Union versus the USA. Did she play a big part in that?
I think she certainly played a part in it. She spotted Gorbachev, a man I can work with, and I think that, you know, it partly fell into her lap. I think one could hardly say she was the engineer of the bringing down of the wall, but it was very much a part of her era and part of her legacy.
And probably not bad for her stock later on. But Mike, what about Ireland, big conflict? She had her close brush, as we've been talking about, in Brighton herself. There were moments where she was denounced as a traitor, though, weren't there, with the Anglo-Irish agreement by Ian Paisley?
Well, you're denounced by Paisley, at least in those days, you must have been doing something a bit right. She was too implacable and too inflexible. That said, by standing firm against pretty all-out attempt to blowing us out of the island of Ireland, which is what the Provisional IRA and its allies sought to do. She wasn't having that. They failed to kill her. And in a way, the IRA was forced to the negotiating table in more emollient times. They realised they couldn't win militarily. They think they may win politically over the long haul. We'll see. What's that birth rate? So she laid the grounds for what John Major and Tony Blair did later on. She was one of these people who foreigners, you didn't have to tell them who she was. In America, people said on the news, Margaret Thatcher said today, and there was no explanation. Used to see her picture up on the posters. And in Eastern Europe, I once saw her mobbed in a Soviet republic before the fall by, you know, 1/4 million people. She was a symbol, all right.
And Larry, what do you make of you know, the class angle of this, we talked about, obviously, her, she broke the mould on gender, but she was the daughter of a grocer. She got to the top of the Conservative Party. It's now led by an Etonian with various other Etonians around him.
Yes, I mean, I think she was representative of a particular strand of Britain, wasn't she? I think she
Same as Ted Heath.
I think she was more in tune with middle class, outer suburbia than Ted Heath ever was. But I think that, you know, she was plugged into a certain sensibility in Britain, the Daily Mail, Daily Express reading classes. She knew instinctively what those sort of people were thinking. And
well, she thought she did. William Whitelaw once said she thinks she's got a hotline to the people of Britain, but she hasn't.
Well, a certain group of them, I think.
The phrase, Polly, that Cameron used for a long time, about a broken society. People who don't like Margaret Thatcher say that you could trace that broken society back to her watch. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, there's no doubt that her 1980s saw this rapid escalation of inequality. We'd become, by the mid-70s, we'd become more equal than we'd probably ever been in modern history. And when she took over, only one in seven children was poor. By the time she left office, it had become one in three. And it's barely moved since then. It has a bit. Labour did a bit of good. It's sliding back now again fast. And there doesn't seem any prospect of pulling society back to any kind of level of equality that it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And I think that is an enduring legacy, and I don't quite see how anybody knows how they're going to put that back together. And from that flows the big welfare bill, because people are not paid enough to support their families. From that flows the soaring away at the top in a way that's, you know, it seems to be uncontainable by anybody. And I think most people think the prospect of an ever-widening gap is quite alarming.
Mike, does it go back to the kind of character thing that Margaret Thatcher didn't have, you know, daughter of a grocer, we should talk about the character thing, didn't have bourgeois guilt that some others had had, other conservative leaders, and pulled away some of the sort of restraining influences?
Well, she took a view that the Tory toffs who had never done a day's work in their life, the Etonians and the Guards officers with the military crosses who surrounded, and who were deeply patronising to her, by the way, in the 1970s before she became whom she became. They all were. Yes, she did feel that they were paternalists and they didn't want to let people, ordinary people, fulfil their potential. We all know the rhetoric because we've got a used to it, and some people have benefited from it, but an awful lot of people have been left behind. It's worth noting here that Mrs. Thatcher created more comprehensive schools when Education Secretary than did her old enemy, Shirley Williams. I was with Mrs. Thatcher the night she won the election in Finchley Town Hall. She devoted half the speech to attacking Shirley Williams in person as a silver spoon socialist who had brought this country to her knees. That was on her mind that night. It never got reported.
The biggest icon or image of her will be as the first woman prime minister. Do you think she may have played by men's rules, but just the fact of her example did change things, didn't it?
Oh, without doubt. I don't think at the moment that she became leader, and particularly when she became a successful leader, there is no doubt that from then onwards, nobody could ever say a woman can't do this or that. And so psychologically, it broke enormous numbers of barriers. It made a huge difference. What was sad was that she was not interested in that at all. She was, in fact, the only post-war prime minister to have had for a time a cabinet with no other woman in it but herself.
Only 18 months. Janet Young was in it for 18 months. She's the only one in 18 years.
Who was in no way threatening to her because she was in the Lords. She liked to be the one bright suit in the row of grey suits. She liked to stand out. She was not about putting a ladder up for other women
at
all.
She liked men, didn't she? She'd much
she liked men, yeah. But she particularly didn't really want other women there. There were plenty of other women she might have helped along the way, but she didn't. And that has been part of her legacy, that there are still in the Tory party so very, very few women.
She left her mother's name out of her Who's Who entry until our late lamented colleague Hugo Young pointed it out in his book One of Us, ironic title, and she said it was an oversight, but of course it wasn't. Dad was everything, and he was a tough municipal working-class Tory who had come up the hard way there and believed in all that stuff.
And Larry, finally, the big argument this week is all about state funeral versus not state funerals, and we're finding out what the distinctions between the different grades of funerals are.
She's getting two-star unleaded.
Whether horses wear boots and so on. I mean, when the pomp and ceremony, whatever it is done. Do you think the country's in a mood now to sort of look back fondly on a woman who knew what she wanted and largely got it? Or
I think the reaction will be mixed. I think Mrs. Thatcher was a very divisive figure, and there will be people who love Mrs. Thatcher who will be very, very sad that she's gone, and there will be people who didn't like Mrs. Thatcher who will be glad that she's gone. I think that it's not going to be a Princess Diana, everybody in it together. It's going to be a much, much more divisive affair than that, I think.
She lacked sympathetic imagination. She didn't have qualities of lovability as Churchill did. Churchill was divisive, but he was much more of a human being. He wept, he laughed, he drank too much.
Polly, lastly, we should focus very briefly, as she always did at the end of her prime ministership, on Europe and Britain's relationship with us.
The great irony is that she is the one who signed the Single European Act, which brought us closer to Europe than ever before, and that's what she left behind. Yeah. And she didn't really turn ultra-Eurosceptic until after she'd left office.
So we could do a kind of counterintuitive conclusion, so wrap up our little tribute to the woman who created comprehensive schools and signed the Single European Act, and I'm sure there must be a third one. But for now, that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Michael White and to Larry Elliott. You can catch up on the latest developments as the tributes pour in at guardian.co.uk/politics, where you'll also find Andrew Sparrow's excellent live blog. My name's Tom Clark, the producer was Matt Hill, and thanks very much indeed for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.